So I'm Mad of London and I'm a punk grime artist and I'm also an activist and a mum. And I first met Tom when I was at uni at Greenwich University doing philosophy. And Tom was one of those people who was just ridiculously smart. He was barely there, but when he came in, he would just like know everything anyway. And I was really struggling because I didn't come from like a formal education background. I kind of got in through the back door, as it were, and I really struggled to understand what was being said. And then here was this guy that would just rock up whenever he felt like it and be like, "Oh yeah, this is the answer, but we've got more pressing matters," and be talking about like political stuff that I didn't really get at the time. So yeah, that's how I met Tom at uni.
Well, let's just say something about Tom, because he's known publicly for being this guy called Agent Kingfisher, who was playing games with the security services, special branch, these sorts of people, the Royal James Bond premiere in London, one of the films, for example. But so maybe you could just say something about his background, because obviously he came to uni. With already having maybe his parents, or he got a bit of a sort of leg up when it came to how the world really works.
Well, he just came from a small town up north. I can't remember the name of it. I think it's far up north. But yeah, I don't know whether like I want to say too much about his history because I only met him at that point in his life, and you know, social class and mobility is quite fluid, you know, so I don't want to make any judgments about whether he was like privileged or not, if you know what I mean.
I mean, what about, say, his parents? He'd obviously had a bit of things going on in his life before he came down to Greenwich, hadn't he?
I can't really say too much about what he had going on in his life before I met him, because he never really talked about his life. He always was obsessed with what was going on in the outside world and, you know, kind of. He educated me largely about politics and music. He took me to my first protest. So, you know, we didn't really touch upon his personal life at home.
Okay, right. Well, no, I don't want to press you on that. So, what was it like when you first met him?
It just seemed like he was preoccupied with what was going on with the Lib Dem and Conservative coalition and the cuts to the student finances at the time. So this is all what led up to kind of being present at the protest. And he took me to an anti-capitalist protest called Occupy LSX, Occupy the London Stock Exchange, which was kind of a movement that said, you know, we don't need austerity measures. And we just need more measures against the ruling class kind of
Yeah, well,
thing.
these were heady days. I mean, with the coalition government, the Conservatives had gotten into bed, Cameron, with Clegg from the Lib Dems, and although the Lib Dems as a party had guaranteed there would be an ending of all tuition fees for higher education, that never happened because they basically sold out.
Crippled.
Yeah, they sold out. So this was a very big protest as well, wasn't it? So maybe you can say something about the student protests, about the Lib Dems lying, you know, in their election pledges, and also about Occupy.
It's all a bit vague because it was quite a while ago, but I remember it was my first protest, and I went first to, I think I went first to the student, what are known as the student riots. I think they, was it Milbank? I think they smashed up Milbank. And it was, I thought it was absolutely mental. I'd never been to anything like it in my life. I'm from a working, like very working class background. And I don't think it's like untrue to say that we don't even know where to look for the protest, you know, like, or information. I always found that that was a problem. It seemed to be the people at the unis knew, or the unions. But if you're just kind of like from an estate, you don't know where these protests are happening, so I was quite overwhelmed with it. And then he took me to the London Stock Exchange one, and it kind of opened my mind to a whole different way of like seeing society and what you can do. It was quite exciting. It seemed quite exciting at the time that people were just trying to make a statement, and they seemed to be pushing the boundaries of like what is acceptable in society. Yeah, I can't remember the question though.
Well, look, the city of London is a sort of hub of everything in a way, isn't it? I mean, it's the wealth, the ownership of everything in the city. And this is one of the things that, even though we don't necessarily articulate it, we kind of feel that over the last, what, 50 years or so in my lifetime, slowly but surely, the country that we owned, I mean, the government owned pretty much everything. All the infrastructure was the people you voted in controlled everything, the railways, the telephones. It was before the days of the internet. They controlled the water, the gas, electricity, all this stuff that we now go, oh my God, it's really expensive. We used to vote in and out the people that owned it and ran it. So the city seems to have sort of triumphed because they now own it all. Anyway, so maybe you could say something about, getting when it was called Occupy, right? The stock exchange. Obviously, you can't actually, or could you? Could you actually get into the stock exchange to take it
I
over?
don't think anyone successfully got in that I know about, but they occupied outside for many months, from what I remember. And then when during that time when I knew Tom, he became like more like less interested in doing completing his degree. And I was kind of trying to convince him, like, you're nearly there, you should finish in the third year. I think this was 2011, but he was really committed to kind of the activist movements that was happening. And I think he started talking about at some point Tavistock. And I mean, I might be conflating this slightly with a few other people because I spoke to a few people at the time, but getting really preoccupied with undercover cops during Occupy LSX. And it came to light that Tavistock apparently had infiltrated some of these groups where they were holding these mass meetings and using neuro-linguistic programming techniques to try and control these meetings or something. And I think it all is now public knowledge that that was happening. Have you heard of this?
Well, look, Tavistock Institute is basically about controlling the population
Yes,
through,
social engineering.
and it's like the nudge unit, basically. These are the people that say, we want everyone to do this, something that they won't necessarily want to do. So we will manipulate them into doing it by X, Y, and Z, usually via the press, the media, and things like that.
Yeah, and just,
So,
yeah, exactly. Little things I've seen, even in doctor surgeries, they'll say 99% of people turn up for their appointments, and you don't want to be the 1%, but that will be a fabrication to try and get you to behave a certain way. For instance, that's an example of a nudge, what they call a
So
nudge.
Tavistock is one of the leading institutes in the world, a bit like, I think Vance Packard wrote a book years ago, The Hidden Persuaders. The idea is you decide you want to do something, but actually, and you think it's you that's decided you want to do it, whether it's to buy someone, make a choice in life of some sort, but actually you've been maneuvered into the situation where subconsciously. But anyway, what about this police infiltration? Because this, you can be straying into the area of paranoia here, because with police infiltration, it's difficult to prove. Did you manage to prove it?
Well, it came to light, didn't it, that there was police operating within London, Occupy LSX. And I think I can't remember where I read it, but I think, there's a lot of post like hoc evidence where police infiltrate even the smallest campaigning groups. So I don't think it's paranoid to stipulate that there are undercover cops in these protest movements, especially that one that was, such a what is the word, in, like annoyance
Yeah,
to
well,
the.
it would. Yeah, it certainly would. But what I mean is, you can point your finger at one person, say, "Oh, I think you're an infiltrator," and you could be wrong, and you could be right. But this is partly why they do it, I guess, is to
Well,
just try
yeah,
and.
it's difficult because is it par it's very difficult to say, because Tom did get end up getting sectioned because of this, but I mean, is it paranoia if it can if it's likely to be the case? But yeah, like you say, the problem is who you turn your gaze towards and try to work out who the undercover cops are, because they're so. It's so difficult to determine because obviously they're undercover. The whole nature of it is very difficult.
Well, maybe
So,
get them drunk. I don't know, but anyway. So just take us through, because he had a really sticky end, poor old Tom. So maybe it's a good idea to break it to listeners now, but just take us through how your relationship with him developed and how it ended.
well, I got given a guitar, and Tom was a really like cute guitar player and a musician. So we would spend time together, and he really educated me into like the world of punk and activism. So he was a big person in my life, considering now I'm a punk grime MC that plays guitar in a band. So yeah, our relationship was kind of based around music and activism. He also introduced me to somebody who I went on to have a baby with, and we would always just kind of hang out in the same spots after a while, in the same kind of, there was a few activist communities that branched off after Occupy LSX. There was like one called the Nomadic Gardens in Shoreditch in East London, and then another activist crew developed out of that called Anal, which was an acronym for the Autonomous Nation of Anarchist Libertarians, that opened loads of kind of state government buildings, and they were, really important buildings. Some of them, they were next to the Queen's House, and they were like old banks in, next to Trafalgar Square that had been abandoned. So, we kind of were coming under the radar quite a bit. I think one of them was a Russian oligarch's house as well in Belgravia. So yeah, I was around during this whole time that we were partaking in these activities. And yeah, so during that time, Tom would become more educated about the history of spies and the role of MI5. The increasing surveillance operation that was being disseminated in the country, and the increasing technological advancements, where everybody was kind of by proxy surveilling each other by having camera phones, and the rise and proliferation of camera phones. How he would talk about how we would police each other, like a bit like how Michel Foucault talks about the panopticon. Like, is it Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon, where it's kind of like one person, and but you don't know whether they're looking, so you behave accordingly. So he was really fascinated with these ideas, but he also was very preoccupied with revealing who might be the undercover cop, which drove him to do certain things that people might say are quite extreme. Like, he cut off someone's dreadlock because he was convinced that they were an undercover cop, and kind of paraded it in the streets outside of the police station just outside Waterloo. And I do feel like he was tormented by either real undercover cops or people who were just posing as undercover cops to aggravate his mental condition, saying, yeah, I'm an undercover cop. Because it could be a double bluff, it's hard to say, or
Well,
whether
yeah,
it's
I
just
mean, you know
somebody
that
getting
this is also
annoying.
possibly tormenting, if this guy is not an undercover cop, it's tormenting the guy who's missing his dreadlock as well, isn't it?
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, that is there is that as well, but I think that's a result of, the state surveillance. And I mean, I don't want to completely say Tom wasn't at all responsible for his actions, but I feel like he was being largely determined by the situation that was happening.
I mean, it sounds, what you're saying is fascinating because you're right. The anarchists generally are extremely sensitive about having photos taken, this sort of thing. In fact, most sensible anarchist meetings make sure that nobody's got a phone with them, for example, so that might be being listened to. And this makes it a bit difficult to organise, and it makes it necessary. May make it more difficult to. To trust people around you, you think, oh, well, maybe they're
Yeah.
hiding something, so it's ever so difficult in the modern world. I see what you mean, to actually be kind of off the surveillance network.
Well, it came out that I can't remember his name, Mark something, even had a baby. He was an undercover cop and he had a baby with one of the activists. And there's probably an element of I don't know if you're aware of a book by R.D. Lang called The Divided Self, where he talks about people taking on their characters and kind of becoming the character. And it's almost like I don't know, I'm just speculating whether these undercover cops, they're putting on this character so much, maybe they just feel like they are that, and they maybe have this bit of split personality, because it's blooming mental that they had a baby with an activist whilst they were lying about
Yeah, I think this
being
is Mark
undercover.
Kennedy you're talking about.
Yeah, that's the name, yeah.
I mean, the other thing is, of course, I mean, people kind of miss this often, is that the groups that were being spied on by the police weren't actually necessarily committing any crimes, or they certainly weren't committing serious crimes. I mean, these powers are there for them to infiltrate things like organized crime gangs,
Terrorist groups,
international class A drug dealers, and this sort of thing, but they're being used on squatters.
And even I remember watching a documentary where, there would even be undercover cops in like little vegan groups or animal welfare groups and things like that. And I feel I kind of used to joke and be like, is our British policing system that bored that they're following these, cat lovers around or whatever. So because of that fact, and like just the nature of the times, I didn't think, that what he was saying was implausible, and someone had to be that cop. But I just used to kind of I'm very I'm gonna do what I want no matter what the consequences, so I never was that bothered about who was this undercover cop at the time. But and I knew if I let it bother me, it would permeate my psyche, and then maybe I would become, really anxious and stuff. But he did end up getting sectioned by the mental team. I think his mum ended up calling them mental health ward. Sorry, mum, if I'm wrong. But I think that might have happened. But I think there was a bit of a different end, because the world that she lived in was so different. I mean, if you're not aware or not partaking in activist groups and you're not politically aware in any way, and you hear your child or your friend talking about undercover cops, you're going to think they're bloody mental. But the reality is that there definitely was undercover policing in those movements. And I think Tom's behaviour got progressively more, I wouldn't say aggressive, but more urgent, and more took a more serious tone at some point, because he was becoming more distressed.
So, I mean,
And
how did he respond to being sectioned? Because this can actually exacerbate the problem, can't it?
I know he was diagnosed with ADHD, and he was kind of impervious to medications and drugs, I think. And he would talk about his Ritalin or his ADHD medication might have got which one that was wrong as a bit of a gateway drug, like he's been on that, and it seemed like he wasn't that bothered about what he put into his body. I don't really know too much, but he just seemed to just drink. Like, I remember if we was at the pub and someone had left a drink on the table, he would just drink it. He wouldn't question if there was Rohypnol in it or something. He'd just be like, yeah, it's fine, you know. But he was this massive, like, guy that was like, just, he wasn't fat or anything, but he was just like 6'3" or something and just tall. And he just was as strong as an ox, really. So you didn't think, like, you just kind of thought he was going to be fine. And he usually just was.
So, I
But
mean, was he, I mean, alcohol's one, but was he have on recreational drugs as well? If you want to, I mean, you don't have to share that with us, but it might give an idea.
massively, I don't think any more than like your average 27-year-old boy who's, you know, not in employment. He wasn't on, as far as I know, any hard drugs regularly. So yeah, I mean, I think he took his ADHD meds on and off, probably smoked some weed, and maybe took some other stuff like casually, but not all the time.
Right, so amphetamines, things like
I've always been a very drug-free person, so most of the drug taking, because people know that happens when I'm like turning away. So,
well,
but I've
fair enough.
done.
Look, I'm asking some pretty personal questions there. But anyway, look, I'll let you carry on with your tale of Tom.
Yeah, so you asked about his the mental health hospital thing, and that's why I started talking about, because you said about how he experienced it. I know he did get increasingly distressed because he was sectioned more than once, and one time he did abscond, and he ended up at my house. And I remember him, you know, saying that they had pulled up and they were revealing himself and they were tormenting him, and he was getting really stressed out about it. And I wasn't sure what to believe. I wasn't sure whether he was absolutely cracking up. I wasn't sure if the state were using like the term madness as a way to disarm him and for everyone to not believe him. And then subsequently, he w would have been isolated because of that. I wasn't sure if they were revealing himself to him, and they were just teasing him, knowing that other people wouldn't believe him. It was really hard to know.
Well, I mean, sorry to interrupt you again, but this is one of the things that they do at this level, is to destabilize people to such an extent that they would never be a credible witness. And that may be because some of the things that they're up to are criminal, and that, to a certain extent, they're afraid of somebody like Tom who's onto them.
Yeah, and Tom had a lot of charisma. He was very passionate. He was very determined. He gave up any comfortability to fight on the side of the underdog, you know. So if he was middle class, he certainly relinquished any kind of middle class privileges mostly. I know you can never really like go, oh, it's all right, don't put me on the wheel, whatever. I don't know if he's done that, but you know, he lived like basically a homeless person. But he had his network. It's a bit different when you're homeless because of trauma, obviously. He had a network, so you know, but he would sleep on the streets and kind of, you know, he would never look down on anybody. He was a really lovely guy. He would always just warn me though. He would say to me, don't get too close to me. Let me turn off that WhatsApp. Say, don't get too close to me because they'll come for you. And, you know, I kind of just used to ignore him. But sometimes I would maybe think what it would be like to think like that and take it seriously. But I could feel myself getting dragged into this kind of paranoid state. So, you know, there was a lot of other peripheral activities going on as well with some of the other activists that were quite more serious and involved like things abroad, things with like Anonymous, the hacking group, and things like that. So there was a number of individuals who was around me, which kind of made it very likely, really, that we were being watched. But Yeah, I just would ignore it. But yeah, he started ramping up his political actions, and he started taking it like much more seriously and trying to get people on board with him. He tried to get people to say, I think The Guardian printed an article about MI5 keeping files on anyone that attended any of these student protests, and they had cameras attached to their bodies somewhere, or and they would bring cameras and it would just literally be taking photos of everybody there. And then yeah, they would be compiling a file, a document, dossier on you, whatever. And but apparently because of the Freedom of Information Act, you could demand to see your files. So he was trying to get people to go to MI5 and demand to see our files, and he was putting increasing pressure on trying to figure out who these undercover cops were who were infiltrating, the group. But that action in and of itself was what broke up a lot of the group, because everyone started getting paranoid and not wanting to organize, and it was causing arguments between people alongside, like people just being strained by bailiffs and moving and just the pressures of living as a political squatter. Because I feel like, it's an option for for a lot of the people there. They're politically squatting to kind of pursue their humanitarian actions, but then it gets kind of squandered by the lifestyle.
Well, look, taking your fight to the security services, to MI5, Milbank, this is, did you? I wonder if you ever thought, or any of your friends thought, well, maybe Tom is working for them. I mean, if it has this effect on splitting up a group, I mean, this is, isn't this the sort of thing that people at MI5 wanted?
Yeah, I never ever thought that. It was just not, that wasn't, it was, that was just not if you met him. I think personally, you just can smell a cop from a mile away. I've got a pretty good nose for it. I know that sounds really weird, but I feel like I've got really good intuition, and I've even just, when you see people on the train, you kind of half guess their job. I'm quite good at that game. I can't say I can do it every single time. But there is something, there's certain, how they do, what was it called? Phrenology, was it, when they used to do criminal profiling by physical characteristics? Yeah, I feel like you can do that with cops. Like, there's a certain look to a cop. But no, I just don't think there's any way on earth that Tom was, that would have been a really weird twist
Too much,
plot.
yeah, maybe. But I
Yeah,
mean, the thing is,
he did actually, he did, sorry to just, I'd say, he did actually hope that he would end up being employed by MI5 at one point, because he was like, I can't go against them anymore because it's too much. Maybe they'll just employ me and I could be like an undercover,
Well, you could be a
undercover.
double agent or a triple agent or something,
Yeah,
maybe, you know.
he would suggest that, but he was very open about that. And I'm not sure how serious he was. I
Anyway, it
think he
would
might
be a
have
very
been.
deep cover for him to. Apparently, he got nicked for urinating in the lobby of MI5, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it wasn't just, I think he formed a group of fellow, urinators. Piss on MI5 was the hashtag, as it
Okay.
were.
But anyway, so what happened to him? Because he came to a bit of a sticky end.
I remember exactly when I last saw him, because it was the night he died, and it was the 21st of August, and my baby was just under one, so it was 2018, and we was at a place called a nomadic garden. A lovely place where I picked up my second baby father. And it was a community gardens, but they also had like bonfires and food, and it was like an initiative to reuse abandoned land to benefit the community. So we was all there, and he was saying again to me, he used to call me Miss Moneypenny, and he was saying like, you need to stay away from me. Like it's getting increasing the threats, and I don't want anything bad to happen to you. Which was like, oh, so sweet. He said that to me whilst I was sitting on this like abandoned pirate ship in the middle of Shoreditch, and I was just going about my day there, my night there, my evening there, and I did notice something a bit odd, and I'm quite good at not letting things get to me, but there was a guy, there was a djembe circle, and there was a guy with dreads, a white guy with long dreads playing the djembe, and then what would you, I could only describe as like a meathead, like someone who's a bit fat, a bit stocky, a bit bald, a bit redneck, kind of look, kind of pulled him to the side, started talking to him, and kind of pulled him away from the group, and I just happened to be behind, and I was like, that's odd. And I followed behind for a minute, just kind of watching, and then they noticed me, and when they noticed me, they started kind of, it looked like they were pretending to comment on the flowers. And I was like, I think they are undercover cops. I did. That was the first time I think I'd ever thought that somebody was actually an undercover cop and being convinced of it. And then, yeah, I said to Tom, and Tom wasn't, he was just like, of course, like, haven't you been listening to me the whole time? And then just kind of a bit frustrated and wandered off. And then he said that night that he wanted to come back to mine, but I said no because my baby dad was dealing with schizophrenia. And last time Tom came to the house, he tried to like, my baby dad tried to like take the baby, and it was a bit mental. But anyway, moving on. So I said no. I said, no, you can't come to the house, Tom, tonight. And he was like, oh, I'm just going to go and get on it then. And I was just like, be careful, darling. Yeah. And so, the next morning was my birthday. I left him, gave him a hug. See you later, Tom. I think he was smoking a spliff on the around the fire and just playing guitar, what he did best. Oh yeah, no, that something did happen actually before that. He got up on the table, he stopped the party, and he declared war on MI5, and he said we need to formulate a private army just like the City of London do. So that was an important point. I nearly missed there. So yeah, and everyone listened. There was about 100 people there, and they all clapped. And he said he was going to go down there a certain date. I can't remember. Probably the next day. Yeah. So the next morning I woke up. It was my birthday, and yeah, I got a text from my best friend's mum saying her boyfriend was dead, and that was Tom, and I was really shocked. Obviously, and I don't think the mum realised that that was like my best mate as well. And she said to tell Sylvia. I don't even know if I remember telling Sylvia or if I had to tell her. But yeah, so they said it was drugs at the inquest. I ended up standing up at the inquest and giving my what for, what I thought about it all. But yeah, so he died at 28 on my birthday.
Well, so drugs. Would you think that's plausible? Might he have done that?
I reckon he could have took some drugs, not in an overdose fashion, but he was 28. He was generally healthy. He was big build, and he was open about going to score some drugs. So I've always contested, and not just because it's a possibility, but because I think it's good to raise suspicion to keep his story alive, and to not, and if there is a possibility, it's better not to just close it off. But I think there definitely is a possibility that the government or MI5 gave him a dodgy batch of drugs. In the inquest, they were very unopen about speaking to anybody. Like, I was with Tom the night he died, and they didn't want to hear from me. And, you know, it was very peculiar that they only wanted to hear from the establishment. Like, the psychiatrist got up and just said how he was unkempt. Like, that's relevant. And preoccupied with undercover cops,
Well, I mean,
which
it
was a
sounds a
sign
bit
that he was
stage
mentally
managed,
ill.
maybe. But what about, I mean, this incident, you know, where you see these people who are, look like they might be undercover cops, did you connect the two with Tom's death?
I did connect them, but I know that correspondence doesn't necessarily equate to causation, but I do think it is a possibility, because, you know, it's the deep state, and I just think he was annoyance, a nuisance. He did have a trial coming up with MI5. They were taking it seriously. He was gaining, you know, some support for his ideas. It was a pain in the ass. And, you know, who's really gonna question somebody who does generally, you know, dip in a bit of drugs if they, you know, if they died from drug take? No one's gonna go, oh, well, most people would just go, it wouldn't be looked at as that suspicious, I reckon, you know, for MI5. It could just, you know,
Well,
give him.
what about the, I mean, MI5 don't like going to court and giving evidence, do they?
There's that as well. So yeah, I've always thought that it could be MI5, and I mean, they're a clandestine government operation. It's not like our government doesn't kill people, is it? It doesn't generally tend to kill its own people as much. But I mean, it's not like it's the most compassionate government. Look at the state of it.
Mad of London, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony.